but he died to live. Says Hirth, there can be no doubt that Confucius has had a greater influence on the development of the Chinese national character than many emperors taken together. He's therefore one of the essential figures to be considered in connection with any history of China. That he could influence his nation to such a degree was, it appears to me, due more to the peculiarity of the nation than to that of his own personality. Had he lived in any other part of the world, his name would perhaps be forgotten. As we've seen, he had formed his character and his personal views on man's life from a careful study of documents closely connected with the moral philosophy cultivated by former generations. What he preached to his contemporaries was therefore not all new to them, but having himself, in the study of old records, heard the dim voice of the sages of the past, he became, as it were, the megaphone, phonograph, through which were expressed to the nation those views which he had derived from the early development of the nation itself. The great influence of Confucius's personality on national life in China was due not only to his writings and his teachings as recorded by others, but also to his doings. His personal character, as described by his disciples and in the accounts of later writers, some of which may be entirely legendary, has become the pattern for millions of those who are bent on imitating the outward manners of a great man. Whatever he did in public was regulated to the minutest detail by ceremony. This was no invention of his own, since ceremonial life had been cultivated many centuries before Confucius, but his authority and example did much to perpetuate what he considered desirable social practices. The Chinese speak of Buddhism and the doctrines of Lao Tse and Confucius as the three teachings. Together, they constitute the basis and point of departure of all later Chinese thought. Their thorough study is a necessary preliminary to the establishment of any real intellectual and moral community between the great people of the East and the Western world. There are certain things to be remarked in common of all these three teachers, of whom Gautama was indisputably the greatest and profoundest, whose doctrines to this day dominate the thought of the great majority of human beings. There are certain features in which their teaching contrasts with the thoughts and feelings that were soon to take possession of the Western world. Primarily, their personal and tolerant doctrines, their doctrines of a way, of a path, of a nobility, and not doctrines of a church or a general rule. And they offer nothing either for or against the existence and worship of the current gods. The Athenian philosophers, it's to be noted, had just the same theological detachment. Socrates was quite willing to bow politely or sacrifice formally to almost any divinity, reserving his private thoughts. This attitude is flatly antagonistic to the state of mind that was growing up in the Jewish communities of Judea, Egypt, and Babylonia, in which the thought of the one God was first and foremost. Neither Gautama, nor Lao Tse, nor Confucius had any inkling of this idea of a jealous God, a God who would have none other gods, a God of terrible truth, who wouldn't tolerate any lurking belief in magic, witchcraft, or old customs, or any sacrificing to the God-King, or any trifling with the stern unity of things. Sixth, the intolerance of the Jewish mind did keep its essential faith clear and clean. The theological disregard of the great Eastern teachers, neither assenting nor denying, did, on the other hand, permit elaborations of explanation and accumulations of ritual from the very beginning. Except for Gautama's insistence upon right views, which was easily disregarded, there was no self-cleansing element in either Buddhism, Taoism, or Confucianism. There was no effective prohibition of superstitious practices, spirit-raising, incantations, prostrations, and supplementary worships. At an early stage, a process of encrustation began and continued. The new faiths caught almost every disease of the corrupt religions they sought to replace. They took over the idols and the temples, the altars and the censers. Tibet today is a Buddhistic country, yet Gautama, could he return to earth, might go from end to end of Tibet, seeking his own teaching in vain. He would find that most ancient type of human ruler, a god-king, enthroned the Dalai Lama, the living Buddha. At Lhasa, he would find a huge temple filled with priests, abbots, and lamas, he whose only buildings were huts and who made no priests, and above a high altar he would behold a huge golden idol, which he would learn was called Gautama Buddha. He would hear services intoned before this divinity, and certain precepts, which would be dimly familiar to him, murmured as responses. Bells, incense, prostrations would play their part in these amazing proceedings. At one point in the service, a bell would be rung and a mirror lifted up, while the whole congregation, in an access of reverence, bowed lower. About this Buddhist countryside, he would discover a number of curious little mechanisms, little wind wheels and water wheels spinning, on which brief prayers were inscribed. Every time these things spin, he would learn, it counts as a prayer. To whom? He would ask. Moreover, there would be a number of flagstaffs in the land carrying beautiful silk flags. Silk flags which bore the perplexing inscription, Om Mani Padme Hum, the jewel is in the lotus. Whenever the flag flaps, he would learn it was a prayer also, very beneficial to the gentleman who paid for the flag and to the land generally. Gangs of workmen employed by pious persons would be going about the country cutting this precious formula on cliff and stone. And this, he would realize at last, was what the world had made of his religion. Beneath this gaudy glitter was buried the Aryan way to serenity of soul. We've already noted the want of any progressive idea in primitive Buddhism, in that again it contrasted with Judaism. The idea of a promise gave to Judaism a quality no previous or contemporary religion displayed. It made Judaism historical and dramatic. It justified its fierce intolerance because it pointed to an aim. In spite of the truth and profundity of the psychological side of Gautama's teaching, Buddhism stagnated and corrupted for the lack of that directive idea. Judaism, it must be confessed, in its earlier phases, entered but little into the souls of men. It let them remain lustful, avaricious, worldly, or superstitious. But because of its persuasion of a promise and of a divine leadership to serve divine ends, it remained, in comparison with Buddhism, bright and expectant, like a cared-for sword. Seventh. For some time, Buddhism flourished in India, but Brahmanism, with its many gods and its endless variety of cults, always flourished by its side. And the organization of the Brahmins grew more powerful, until at last they were able to turn upon this caste-denying cult and oust it from India altogether. The story of that struggle is not to be told here. There were persecutions and reactions. But by the 11th century, except for Orissa, Buddhist teaching was extinct in India. Much of its gentleness and charity had, however, become incorporated with Brahmanism. Over great areas of the world, as our map has shown, it still survives. And it's quite possible that in contact with Western science, and inspired by the spirit of history, the original teaching of Gautama, revived and purified, may yet play a large part in the direction of human destiny. But with the loss of India, the Aryan way ceased to rule the lives of any Aryan peoples. It's curious to note that while the one great Aryan religion is now almost exclusively confined to Mongolian peoples, the Aryans themselves are under the sway of two religions, Christianity and Islam, which are, as we shall see, essentially Semitic. And both Buddhism and Christianity wear garments of ritual and formula that seem to be derived through Hellenistic channels from that land of temples and priestcraft, Egypt, and from the more primitive and fundamental mentality of the brown Hamitic peoples.